better illuminate our understanding of the Old Testament, and we'll be working our way through the period of the wilderness and the conquest. We cover, obviously, in this kind of class, more chunks of text at a time than we would if we were just studying straight through the Bible, because there's not been something found for every verse in the Bible. So we'll be working our way through a portion of text that includes stories that I presume you're pretty familiar with. We won't take the time to read all of the stories. We'll summarize some of them. We'll look at a few key verses as they relate to some of these things. I'm already ahead of myself here on the slide. But looking at this time period, we've left Egypt at this point with the Israelites. We've gone through Mount Sinai, and we get up to a place known as Kadesh Barnea. This is where they went to after about 10 months that they spent at Mount Sinai. Kadesh Barnea is something of an oasis just outside the Promised Land. The map here gives you a better idea of where it is. This dot right here is Kadesh Barnea. And you can see how many biblical events are centered in this basic area. The death of Miriam in Numbers 20 is right in that area. The people condemned to 40 years of wandering in Numbers 14 is right there. The site of Aaron's death is there. The rebellion is against Korah is there as well. And so that's something of a home base in the wilderness for the Israelites at this point of their journey. And it's a significant area. It's an important crossroad as well. One of the roads that went from the Gulf up toward Palestine went through that way. And so it was a place where there was a little bit of foot traffic would be coming through anyway. When they stopped here the first time, they sent the spies into the land to spy out the land. Presumably that first trip, they didn't go all the way up around the Dead Sea and across the Jordan. Presumably from Kadesh Barnea, they just went into the Promised Land straightway, unless there's something from the text that I've completely forgotten. But whatever the case may be, they brought back the bad report. Only Joshua and Caleb came back with a good report, and so they were sentenced to 40 years of wandering, and that all of the Israelites would die in the wilderness, who were over 20 years of age, except Joshua and Caleb. And probably this period of wandering in the wilderness wasn't so much a period of roaming around aimlessly in the wilderness. That's kind of how I thought about it when I was a child growing up and I hear that they wander in the wilderness. I just imagine, 600,000 Israelites just kind of meandering around all over the place for 40 years. That's probably not the best way of understanding it, especially when you see how central this location is to what they're doing. Their wandering is probably a lot like Abraham's sojourning in Palestine and Abraham being a pilgrim in Palestine. It's not to say that he was constantly wandering all over the place. He would set up in a spot and stay there for a very long time as something of a home base. And what it means is they didn't have a home in the Promised Land yet. And they probably did journey a little bit here and there, particularly if they had needs that this area could not provide for them. But generally speaking, I think the better picture is that they stayed near this area of Kadesh Barnea during this 40-year period. And then when the time came for them to go into the land, they would have gone from there. So that's Kadesh Barnea, something of a significant area. There's not been any particular archaeological find that relates to them being there, but it's a significant enough place that I wanted to talk about it. Now, moving forward to Numbers chapter 22, we meet a fellow by the name of Balaam. Who can briefly tell me what Balaam's story was? He was a prophet for hire. Okay. Apparently, he was not an Israelite, at least as far as I can tell. But he was a prophet for hire. Who wanted to hire him? Balak. And for what purpose? To curse Israel. So Balak wants to hire the prophet Balaam to curse Israel. And Balaam knows better, but he finds the money too alluring. And so he decides he's going to do that. And four times he tries to curse Israel. And four times he instead blesses them. Of course, that leads to the story of Balaam's donkey, which you're very well familiar with as well. I presume. And so you know the basic story of Balaam. He comes up a few times in the Bible after that as well. One of the interesting things about Balaam, you don't think of him as a major character, even though he shows up from time to time. But one of the interesting things about Balaam is he is one of the people who does show up outside the Bible. There was an excavation of a place called Deir Allah or Deir Allah or something along those lines. Again, my Arabic is, I'd say, rusty, but it would have to exist in order to be rusty. So I'm going to botch some of these city pronunciations, of course. Tell, of course, is the mound of where this city used to be. This is a place where some have identified it as the same place as Succoth in the Bible. That's a debated matter, but it might be the same place. But they excavated Deir Allah, and they found hundreds of fragments of a text written on plaster. And one of the fragments that has been found has become known as the Balaam inscription. This is the fragments of the Balaam inscription. Who can tell me what that says? This is a little bit more of a cleaned up, illustrated kind of version of this. But a couple of lines in particular from this fragment are significant. One, it refers to Balaam the son of Beor, a divine seer is he. And so outside of the Bible, you have this fragment that refers to Balaam the son of Beor, who is a prophet, who is a divine seer. And it goes on to say, it goes on to talk about a divine vision that he received. It says, "Lo, the gods came to him at night and spoke to him." And so a couple of places in this little fragment, you have Balaam mention the fact that he's a prophet, the fact that he receives visions from the gods, probably would be what they would think. There is nothing in particular, at least in this fragment, that talks about his dealings with Israel or the God of Israel. That may or may not have ever existed. Who knows what was written about Balaam outside the Bible in this episode. But it doesn't exist. But it does show us that there was this guy, Balaam. The Canaanites knew who he was. They wrote about him. They recorded him. They knew he was a prophet. And so on the confirmation side, again, we've kind of talked about archaeology, both in terms of confirming the biblical story, which it does some, but really more significantly illuminating the biblical story and helping us understand what's going on. This is a place where it really does more of the confirming work than the illuminating work. It doesn't tell us anything we don't know already about Balaam, but it does tell us very clearly that this was a real historical figure that the people of Canaan knew about as well. Yes, sir. Not in this fragment, at least. I don't know if, again, we just don't know what else was recorded about him, but in the Balaam inscription...
The Bible records it.
Oh, the Bible records it. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking if this...
Killed later.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And this is 600 years after Balaam.
This is dated to? Okay. Anything else on this? One other thing from the wilderness period before we get to the conquest period that I just am going to mention in passing, it's nothing significant, more a little bit of comic relief perhaps. You're familiar, I presume, with the story in the last chapter of Deuteronomy about the death of Moses, where he goes up to Mount Nebo and he is shown the promised land. And then in verse 5, it says, "So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no one knows the place of his burial to this day." Fortunately, this is not one of those things a lot of people have gone after. You know, we talked about the ark when we were in Genesis, and there are all of these expeditions for the ark, and everyone swears they found it, and who knows. Fortunately, not a lot of people have gone looking for the tomb of Moses. There was one story I did come across that I was going to mention just because I think it's kind of funny. Back in 1962, someone set off a small explosive charge near Mount Nebo, and the hole that resulted from his explosives, he then decided that was the tomb of Moses. So if you're looking for something, just blow a hole in the ground and then you can claim that that's what you're looking for, apparently is the way that some people... Obviously, that's not... no archaeologists take that seriously. Well, moving forward then to Joshua and the conquest, of the land. A couple of points more geographically speaking that I think are helpful in thinking through this story and making it a little bit more vivid in our minds. When they came to the border of the Promised Land, this probably would have been at the time that the Jordan River was in its flood stages, which would have been a significant sight to see. Back in those days, during flood stages in particular, the Jordan River would be up to 90 to 100 feet across and up to 12 feet deep. So, you know, I showed you the picture earlier of the Jordan in this kind of windy part, and you see this pretty narrow river there. Don't think of the Jordan as something that's, you know, you, if you had a log, you could step on it and hop the rest of the way across. This would have been a very significant river for them to be crossing, this many of them especially. And as it relates to that, again, you think about this generation. Here's a generation that has left Egypt. They've never really lived near the Nile, and the Nile's not exactly the same as the Jordan anyway, but they haven't even been near the Nile. They've been out in the wilderness. There's an oasis with some springs. But they've never seen a river like this, especially a rushing river in flood stage. This probably would have been a pretty terrifying sight for a lot of the Israelites as they come to the border of the Promised Land. I don't know if you can remember the first time that you were near a rushing river or the first time it really made an impact on you. You know, if you've ever gone tubing or canoeing or something down some pretty serious rapids, you recognize the power that can come with that kind of water. It would have been a pretty shocking sort of thing, a pretty frightening sort of thing. Now, Jericho, of course, is right across the river from where they were camped at this point in their journey. That's the city they go spy out. It's in a plain. You remember how mountainous the middle of Palestine is. Jericho's in a plain outside the mountains. It's something at something of a gateway into the hill country. And it's a spot where they are going to be crossing, where they're going to be going into the hill country, and they couldn't really leave it behind them. It's not a place they could, you know, circumvent, because now they've got an enemy at their back. So this is quite naturally the first spot for them to stop and to attack and to try to take. And we don't know a lot about Jericho's defenses from archaeology. And we don't know a whole lot of city defenses at all from Joshua's time in Palestine. We know some of the defenses from the time before. You remember we looked at some of the walls, some of the gate systems. We looked at the gate system at Megiddo, how it had several layers of gates. Some of those ancient defense systems were still in use. Some cities apparently were unfortified at this time. And some of them had not just, you know, military defense walls, but they were surrounded by a ring of house walls, so to speak, walls that were big enough to have houses in them. And that seems to be what's going on at Jericho at this point. Of course, you know, Rahab lived in a house on the wall, and that seemed to be what was going on. I meant to try to track down a picture of what that would have looked like, and it slipped my mind as I was putting the PowerPoint together. But just as in patriarchal times, the houses had flat roofs. You remember the picture of the house that we looked at, patriarchal kind of house in Mesopotamia. They weren't exactly the same in Palestine at this point, but they still had those flat roofs, which would have been the perfect place to dry a bunch of flax after it was harvested, which is apparently what was going on Rahab's roof. And that's why she used that area and that flax to hide the spies at that point. Now, one thing that I think is very helpful in thinking about the story of Jericho and the conquest of Jericho that I didn't really realize until I started looking into this was the relative size of Jericho and what that means practically speaking for the Israelite procession around it. Jericho was only about 9 to 12 acres. So if you want a nice round number, let's say it was 10 acres. How long would it take you to march around 10 acres? Anyone familiar enough with land to take a stab at that?
2 or 3 hours.
Yeah? Maybe a little bit less than that even. Now, if you've got a big army, it's going to take the whole group a lot longer. But one of the ways I've always thought about this story was, you know, they get up first thing in the morning before the sun rises, and they go there, and they march, and they march, and they march, and it just takes all day long. And then at the end of the day, they go back to their camp. The next morning, they get up again, and they go, and it's this, you know, multi-day kind of thing. It really would not have taken that long for them to get around that city. a little bit longer because it's a group of them instead of just one. But it would have been a pretty quick trip around the city every day for them to make, which explains why they could make 7 trips in one day at the end. I think, of course, you think that through, it makes sense. Ancient population density, from what we know from these excavations, basically there was somewhere between 1 and 200 people per acre in an ancient city on average. Obviously, there's a little bit of a range there. But somewhere between 100, 200 people per acre, a city that's 10 acres, there's really not that many people in this city either. And you can see why they might be scared then, right? You've got about 2,000 people living in this city, and you look across the river and there's 600,000 of them. You know, marching around the city, they don't really have to do. They could probably just walk over it and it would fall down with that many of them. So you can understand why they would be fearful looking at their little town as greatly fortified as it may have been, but how few of them there were versus how many of the Israelites that there were. It would have been a shocking thing to them. Another thing that might be interesting to think about is what would have been going on in their minds as the Israelites made their march. Now, again, this is one of those things where I kind of always had a conception in my mind of what the Jerichoans, is that real, Jerichoans? What they would have been thinking as the Israelites marched. And that is, what are those weirdos doing walking around our city? And I always kind of imagined this mockery from the people of Jericho, that, you know, this is a real stupid military strategy. What are you guys doing walking around in a circle? Probably what they would have thought, just from what we know about the ancient pagan mindset, they probably would have thought that it was some kind of religious exercise. You're marching around it to mark out your territory, to bring your gods to it, or whatever else the case may have been. And far from mocking the Israelites, they probably would have been praying to their gods to be stronger than the God of Israel. They would have recognized it as preparation for war of some kind, and in particular, again, some kind of religious exercise, and they most likely would have seen it in that kind of context, which again puts a little bit of a different spin on what's going on. As for the Israelite army itself, whether here or in other battle scenes, we don't have a whole lot of detail about them and what they would have been armed with. It has been suggested, and I think it's a reasonable guess, to think that they would have come with typical Egyptian military hardware. They had been spending the last 400 years in Egypt, and so I don't know what other kind of military equipment they would have had, although they may have had something else, but that's a guess that has been made. And if that's the case, then as far as the army itself went, they would have had slingers and archers for distance kind of warfare. We know that there are slingers later in Israelite armies, so that certainly fits the picture. They would have had axes and spears and short swords for closer combat, and I meant to find some more of these pictures as well and just didn't get to it. But here is one particular sword that really I found interesting that dates back to Egyptian warfare of roughly this time. This is known as a sickle sword. And one thing that this sickle sword was used in particular for was cutting through body armor. I guess there's something about the way that it's designed that made it more effective at cutting through body armor than other swords. And that's striking because what we know of Canaanite defenses of this same time period is that they had just introduced chainmail as a kind of defense for themselves. They would have had shields and helmets as well, but they had just started using chainmail to protect their bodies in battle. And if the Israelites had these sickle swords to fight against that kind of body armor, it certainly fits the basic context as well. And it also reminds you, you know, when you see this kind of thing, that these people were really fighting wars. Of course, they had God on their side, and that made it a little bit easier for them in a lot of those battles, at least when they actually had God on their side. We'll talk about Ai briefly in a minute. There's not much about it, but it does kind of remind you that this is a real thing. These are real people fighting real wars. Of course, there's always the question of how exactly the city of Jericho fell. And I've heard all kinds of things throughout my life. You know, there's all this archaeological stuff about the walls of Jericho. And, you know, in looking at three different archaeology books and a couple of different commentaries, I really couldn't find anything that supported this notion that there's a whole lot behind it. The closest thing that I found was one archaeologist said that the outer walls fell down the slope of the city mound and the inner walls fell in the gap in between. And that's the closest thing I found to any kind of discussion of the walls of Jericho and how they fell as well. As to the mechanics of the city falling, this is one of those things where people always want to come up with a naturalistic kind of explanation. And I think, you know, of course, you know, it makes sense for skeptics to want a naturalistic explanation to this kind of thing. I don't know why believers slip into that trap all the time. You know, we want to know how it could have happened, even if God wasn't miraculously intervening. Well, that, you know, if you're talking to your neighbor, maybe it's valuable to say, you know, it's not impossible, here's how it could have happened. But I don't think we always want to fall back on that crutch. You know, the same thing, you know, I was just, one of the classes I was in a couple weeks ago, they were talking about some story of someone who got swallowed by a whale and spit back out, and how this could be an explanation of the Jonah story. And well, maybe it is, but the Jonah story says pretty clearly that God prepared a fish specially for this occasion. So we don't need a naturalistic explanation when we're told in the text that it's a miraculous fish to begin with. That's another issue for another day. But people have said all kinds of things about the city of Jericho falling. Some have said, you know, the sound waves from the trumpet somehow knocked it down. Maybe the shock waves from Israel's marching, maybe a combination of the two worked together to make it fall down. One of the explanations I saw that I found particularly humorous is that the large number of Israelites were distracting enough to the people on the city walls that they didn't see other Israelites tearing away at the foundation stones of the wall every day. So they're marching around causing this big diversion while the Israelites are tearing the wall down one stone at a time. Well, you know, is that a plausible thing that could have happened? Well, yes, but that's not what the Bible says, obviously. Others have suggested an earthquake. Jericho is on an earthquake belt, so that certainly is a possibility. But even then, you've got to have some pretty good timing for an earthquake to happen just as you blow those trumpets that last time. So even there, I think you've got something miraculous. It's a miraculous earthquake, like the one that, you know, let Paul free out of prison. Again, I don't know that we need some kind of naturalistic explanation for it. I think the point ultimately is that God caused the walls to fall. Yes, sir. Yes, and that's another thing that is, you know, does the description in Joshua, does it mean that every single wall fell down? Well, obviously not, because Rahab's house didn't. Does it mean that every single wall, every single part of the wall except Rahab's house fell? I don't know that that's necessary either. It just needs to fall enough for the Israelites to get in there and take the city. But again, it's just kind of hard to know exactly what happened there. Like I said, there's not much to say about Ai. The one thing that I was going to say about that, though, is to just kind of remind you of the geography of Palestine and where they're coming from and where they're going and what the trip to Ai would have involved. Jericho is some 850 feet below sea level. It's down near the Dead Sea, down in a plain. So they're going to be going from 850 feet below sea level up to 2,500 feet above sea level to get to Ai. So they've got more than a 3,000-foot vertical march in addition to how far across the land they've got to go to get from one city to the next. Obviously, their fatigue is not why they lost the first battle, but that is something they would have had to deal with as well. All right, I'll stop there for a second. There's some more stuff to talk about, at least briefly, but I've been talking a lot. So any questions or comments about anything we've talked about so far? Any of these various aspects of things? Yeah, Jeremy. No, I didn't. I mentioned the 600,000 that's in the census at the end of Numbers, but I didn't get into the details of that. Is there anything in particular you have in mind?
Well, I just know that's something that skeptics point to.